You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Wes Adams and Tamara Miles. Wes is the founder and CEO of SV Consulting Group. He's led teams that were recognized as one of Fast Company's most innovative brands, won multiple Webby Awards, and received two James Beard Award nominations. Tamara is a consultant and international speaker with over two decades of experience helping leaders improve business performance. She is a professor at Boston College, an instructor at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of The Secret to Peak Productivity. They've co-authored a terrific new book called Meaningful Work, How to Ignite Passion and Performance in Every Employee. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectations
come. Wes and Tamara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us. We're delighted to be here.
Very excited.
So about 10 years ago, my wife and I were brought into the University of Pennsylvania to help curate a two-day conversation about comedy, improv, and positive psychology with Martin Seligman and his team. So our job was to assemble a group of like great comedy minds. So we brought in the founding editor of The Onion, Scott Dickers, former SNL writer and Second City alum Cindy Caponera. We had New Yorker cartoonist Bob Mankoff, which was really cool there. But what was interesting was that we ended up talking way more about improv than we did comedy, because the connection between positive psychology and the tenets of improvisation were actually, they became very, very clear. Having read your book, this would not surprise either of you, right?
Not at all.
Tell me more.
Well, as you know, we reference Second City actually multiple times in the book. One of our classmates, Erica Alam, teaches at Second City and does a lot of corporate workshops. And one of the things that we found in our research was this relationship between leaders and employees, the people that they manage, people among teams. Building trust is so important there. And that philosophy of yes, and when somebody brings a new idea to the table and is vulnerable and exposes themselves, building on that rather than shutting that down draws people in and tells them that they can continue to bring new ideas to the table.
Tamara, did this surprise you?
You know, it was amazing having Erica in the class with us, kind of deconstructing these concepts that we were learning about in positive psychology and applying. She did her thesis research all on, you know, how the two are so interconnected. And Wes and I actually bring Erica to do workshops for some of our clients. So there's definitely a lot of overlap from the basic like playfulness and positive emotions that it generates, stepping outside of yourself and not being in your head. But also, you know, in the book, we kind of chose trust as the key component that it builds. And so I think it's just amazing. And I have this like secret crush on Erica and how she shows up and like all the knowledge that she has. I'm like, oh, I want that. Like, I want to live my life with more of this kind of fun, this yes and, this trust, this vulnerability. You know, I think it's all so interconnected.
I was just talking about this with a colleague who asked me, he's like, what do you know about the literature and the science around courage and bravery? And I don't have a lot, like, that's not necessarily a topic I covered. So before we hopped on, I was just looking at some papers, And it's so connected with regard to your ability to show up as yourself, or and we're many selves, show up as one of yourselves in these spaces with no script, which is how all of us have to live our days. And what we lack that improv, you know, gives us is ways of low risk practice. How do you low risk practice being courageous and a little bit brave? Because it's like, I think our brains pre the knowledge go to, well, you have it or you don't. And it's like, no, nothing's like that. You build the muscles, you get older, all the different things that we know when we study these areas. But still, we're you know, the way we're wired, we go to these sort of areas where we think, we have it or we don't.
Right.
So you write in the introduction to your book, nearly 50% of an employee's experience of meaning at work is tied to what their leaders do or fail to do. So that's a big percentage. Talk more about what that means in the scope of this book.
When we got together and started doing this research, the thing that we focused on was leaders' role in creating meaningful work. So there had been a lot of investigation into how you can make work more meaningful for yourself, how you can find a job that matters to you. And actually, I think I should pause for a second and define meaningful work, because when people hear that, a lot of people think about, oh, you know, working at a nonprofit, or I'm going to work in the healthcare industry and, you know, serve people. And those are all, you know, potentially very meaningful jobs. And this idea of having a purpose is very popular at this point. And that's not exactly what we mean when we talk about meaningful work. When we talk about meaningful work, we're talking about moments of meaning that can happen in every job, every day, across what we call the three C's, or the three sources of meaning, which are community, contribution, and challenge. And community is that belief that you belong, that you can show up authentically. And I think it's very tied to what we'll be talking about, you know, as relates improv. Contribution is this idea that your work matters to other people, that you're contributing to something larger than yourself, whether that's your team, your company, or customers, or people outside of the organization. And challenge is the ability to learn and grow, the sense that you're getting better and working towards your full potential. Yeah.
You also cite Chris Peterson, who's a founding father of positive psychology, who summarized the entire field by saying other people matter. Mm-hmm. That's short and profound.
It's amazing. There's so much research in social sciences, and the most famous one being the Harvard Grant Study of Adult Development, right? Where they followed people, I think it's been over 80 years now. And then they started with a group of men, but then they added their spouses and their children, and they've been following them for 8 decades. And they found that there's like one powerful source of, you know, longevity and well-being, and it's close, meaningful relationships with others. And so I think Chris had like this really beautiful way of explaining things in a way that resonates with people and, you know, kind of carry a deep truth. And this idea that other people matter, they matter for, you know, in the context of work. It's not just about the work that we do, but about the people that we do it with. We have shared goals. Sometimes it's hard. You know, things don't go as planned. We need collaboration. And it's the same in improv, right? You're not alone on the stage. You need to kind of rely on other people, get that gift that they're giving you. Sometimes maybe it's a messy thing that you have to accept and listen and be present and then transform it into something else. And I think there's a lot of parallels, but who you do it with, and it really matters. And so I think in life, at work, in general, for our well-being and for our longevity and our happiness, other people really, really matter.
I had a mentor once who said to me, every business problem is a communication problem. Hmm. And I think that also strikes at the heart of this, which is like, yeah, it's human beings working with other human beings is hard. And that's why in so many different areas, whether it's sports or an orchestra, you know, what are the best teams? And there's a level of harmony and synchrony. And they practice really hard, and they do all these things. And yet we get into business, like no one's practicing.
Right.
No one's practicing.
We, I think that's such an important point, because so often we throw leaders and managers into the deep end and don't give them any tools. You know, we say, oh, you're a great accountant. Here are four accountants for you to manage. And the skills of being a good accountant have nothing to do with the skills of being a good people leader, right? And they're all just like improv. They're all learnable skills. They're all things that you can develop, but it does take practice. It does take intention. And it is a little bit messy. I had the opportunity to take a few classes at UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade, when I was living in New York. And it was really uncomfortable for me, as someone who usually comes into a conversation with an agenda and knowing what I want to say and what I want to get out of it, to have to give up that power, essentially, and roll with usually some things that I wasn't expecting or didn't necessarily like from my improv partners, was a big lesson for me, and one that I think has been hugely influential in my ability to adapt in a business setting, to accept what people give me and to roll with that and have a little bit less of a need for control in that situation, which is so necessary in today's environment where things are changing really quickly.
Yeah, there's another improv concept called follow the follower, and it's very aligned with Peter Drucker's work in terms of knowledge workers and leadership that needs to be sort of agile and moving back and forth, and a lot around modeling. And you mine some really great stories in the book, and I want you to tell about the story about Rob Waldron, the CEO of Curriculum Associates, and his wedding that was almost a rain out.
It's such a great story. And I think it also kind of ties to this whole practice thing, right? We have values that we kind of put on the wall or on the website, but unless we're practicing those values every day, they don't become part of the culture. But Rob, when we were interviewing him for our study, he told us about his wedding day in Newport, Rhode Island. As any couple, you do a lot of wedding planning and you are very excited. All your guests come in. The one thing you can't control is the weather. And so it turned out that on his wedding day was a big storm, big rainy storm in Rhode Island. And they had planned this wedding in one of the well-known Rhode Island mansions on the cliff walk, like on the ocean. And they started, kind of freaking out. And then the bride, his fiance was upset, and they were kind of feeling like the whole wedding was just going to be a disaster and nobody was going to have fun. And, and the wedding planner pulled them aside and said to his bride, the rain is the rain. You can't control what's going to happen, but you can control what you do with it. And everyone's eyes will be on you because everyone follows the bride. So if you go out in the rain and you embrace it and you dance and you have fun, everybody will relax and have fun. But if you're upset and tense and, just not happy about it, then everyone is going to feel that and nobody's going to have a good time. And so they did it. They embraced the rain. They danced in the mud. They had a blast, and it was one of the most memorable and fun days of their lives and their guests' lives. Still probably 30 plus years later, they still remember that moment. And Rob brought that lesson with him to his leadership approach. As a CEO of a large organization, he always remembered that people followed the bride. And as the CEO and the leader, he was the bride. And he wanted to make sure that that he was role modeling the right behaviors. And when he wasn't, that he was accountable to that and admitted it and apologized.
And it's not being Pollyannic, right? But what this is an acknowledgement that the world and our lives are rife with failure. And by the way, I am so much less interested in your success story than I am your fiasco. Like, the fiasco is the thing I want to hear. Right. So that requires a level of vulnerability. And I think organizational vulnerability is something we don't talk enough about. Because things go wrong. Right. And I really didn't know either the founding story of Amnesty International nor sort of that path. And I'd love you to talk that through. Maybe, Wes, you can do this, because it's a cautionary tale.
Yeah. So sort of back to this idea that meaningful work only happens at nonprofit organizations or mission-driven organizations, we explore the story of Amnesty International in the book, which was originally launched, I think, in the late 60s and was very focused on liberating political prisoners and human rights abuses, and kind of grew, eventually got the Nobel Peace Prize, and was this very influential organization. It focused on human rights and human well-being. And there was a report that came out around 2019, I think, that was independently commissioned after a couple of people had taken their own lives, unfortunately, who worked there. And it was about the culture, a toxic culture that had evolved within the organization that was meant to be sort of this bastion of human rights and well-being. And it found there was a lot of bullying of, you know, people of women, of LGBTQ people were reporting that. And really this sense that it wasn't a great place to work. Right. And so this was an organization that was very high in contribution, the idea of contribution, the second C, but very low or non-existent in the first C, community. Right. And what we find is that these three C's, community, contribution, and challenge, they have a multiplier effect. So even if you're working at this incredibly mission-driven organization, if you don't have that community, if you don't feel like you matter or you belong, it doesn't matter. It cancels the others out. Right. And so I think since then, Amnesty has had to do a lot of work to repair the culture there that's been noted as being pretty toxic.
Yeah. We talked to Scott Barry Kaufman recently about his upcoming book, and he has a whole section where he talks about sort of dark healers. And unfortunately, they show up in those spaces, you know, like, you know, anywhere where someone's like claiming guru status or it's approaching that. Unfortunately, that's also a place where this stuff comes out a lot. All right. When I was reading the book, I had this epiphany that Second City has never sort of consciously created onboarding programs. We've done them, but I was like, oh, like everything you're talking about in terms of when you get to that section is, because I do often say to clients, they're like, well, where should we put you? I'm like, we're great at the beginning or the end. Like the beginning in terms of warming up with sort of rituals and mindset and yes and philosophy, or the end is kind of bring it all together. And I think it's great you sort of start with, you guys met at the Master of Applied Positive Psychology at Penn, and that positive introduction course, I mean, maybe it was your first anchor. Talk about what happens there and some of the stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad you picked up on that. That was one of the most surprising findings in our study, that beginnings really matter. And before our study, there hadn't been any other studies that tied this idea of hiring and onboarding to the experience of meaningful work. And so how you start your experience with the organization impacts your whole lifetime in the organization. So it's a real great opportunity for leaders to focus on what truly matters. And so when we started at MAP, you know, it was 48 of us with, you know, different ages, different backgrounds, different, very diverse experiences that we brought to the table. And we all were feeling a little bit insecure about whether or not we belonged. You know, everybody looked so impressive, and do my goals and my experience belong here and all of that. And so one of the first things that we did, and it was James Pawelski that led that. He's the co-founder of the program with Marty. He took us through an exercise called the positive introduction. And it's, you know, we all took the VIA character strength survey. And so we had the results of our signature strengths, and our signature strengths are the top five. So when you go to the VIA website, it's free. Everybody can take the survey, and you get a list, a rank order of your 24 character strengths. And your character strengths are the way you show up in the world, what's really kind of energizing to you when you use, and there are strengths that are valued across cultures and across time. And so we had taken that ahead of the first class, and they had asked us to think about a a character strength story, some time where we used one of our top five strengths and to come and share that. And so talk about being vulnerable, right? We're sharing that with our colleagues that we don't know, and we don't know if that strength is going to be valued or not, or how it's going to be taken, but we all did it. And so one of my signature strengths is the strength of love. So love as a strength is different than love as a feeling or an emotion. Love as a strength is about really valuing close relationships and caring and warmth and all of that. And so I told a story about that. Wes, what was the story you told? I forget.
I told a story about being there for my family when my dad passed away.
And what was the strength that you highlighted there?
You know, that's a great question. I can't remember at the moment, actually.
It's interesting, though, because what I was holding in my brain was, I bet your stories were rife with struggle. That most people's were, because it's like, yeah, you're talking about time to use your strength, but those come in handy usually when the chips are down and you're able to sort of find your way through, I think, with most people. And it's interesting because my wife, Anne, also is a professor of comedy. She runs the first ever BA in comedy writing performance at Columbia College. And when she talks about the difference between stand-ups and improvisers, she says, what improvisation, they're doing perspective taking, right? They go to the audience, get suggestions, and then respond. What's interesting about stand-ups is they have to do perspective giving. First 5 minutes of their act, think about your favorite comedians and their Netflix special. They're all talking about, like, faults and struggles. So John Mulaney's drunk. Amy Schumer's a slut. Yeah, like, Patton Oswalt's a schlub. And it's like, well, why do they do that? And it's like, they're forging connection through this sort of real thing. You know, they're being authentic with the audience. They're learning to trust them and learn how to be communicated to. And it's a bit of a magic trick and sort of a mastery. But I think we all know people like that. Like, when you hear the stories of people who meet Bill Clinton in person, they're always like, oh, I felt like I was the only person in the room.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do.
Yeah, I think I went to Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, and, you know, 70,000 people, and you still feel like she's talking to you personally. It's amazing. I actually love this idea of perspective giving, because I love stand-up. I'm actually going to go see Jim Gaffigan and Jerry Seinfeld perform together. And that's the one thing. It's like they give language to your experience that, you know, the everyday things that you don't even notice. And that's a great way to put it. Yeah. So I think you're right about the strengths. You know, we do rely on them to navigate adversity. It's a huge part of our resilience and how we show up and the tools we have.
I would say, I was going to say, you know, Tamara and I typically do this exercise when we start working with new teams in our consulting work, and more than 80% of people who talk about their proud moment or their moment of strength are talking about a time that was really difficult, a struggle that they went through. So I think this is a very universal human thing, and that vulnerability does create such deep connection among the groups that we work with that allows them to see each other, in some cases for the first time, as people rather than colleagues that they're transacting with. And that forges a really powerful foundation for the rest of the work that we do after.
I'm curious if you have clients who come to you like they do for us for storytelling, because where I've ended up with this is I have to really dig, because I'm like, what do you mean by storytelling? Because it affects everything. Right? It's like, when you really look at it, are you talking communication skills? Are you talking sales? Are you talking leadership? Because the way we show up in the world with our stories is how we create meaning and how we create sort of compelling narratives. I mean, data is great to have, but no one looks at a bunch of numbers and gets like inspired to change the world.
Absolutely. We, through the process of writing this book, we had done many years of study of qualitative and quantitative study, and we had all of these great statistics. Half of the meaning that you experience at work is tied to what your leaders are doing, and all of these, you know, predictions about that impacting your job satisfaction and how long you're going to stay and how well you're going to do and how creative you are and all of that. Nobody cares about any of those statistics, right? Like, nobody, that sounds great, But to bring it to life, to make it to compelling, we talked to so many different leaders across industries and about their experiences, like Rob Waldron's story about the bride, right? That's very memorable, much more so than if I tell you, oh, well, 50% of role modeling, you know, is about the leader, and that's what impacts how people behave in an organization and all of those sorts of things. And so it's a very powerful tool to communicate the culture of an organization, to communicate what behaviors are rewarded, which behaviors are punished. And also that story that you're telling yourself about work is really where meaning comes from. You know, do you believe that you belong? Do you believe that your work matters? Do you believe that you're getting better?
Yeah. And I was just to add, one of the practices that we teach. So yes, leaders come to us all the time. How do I make work more meaningful? And storytelling is a key ingredient in that. And so while we don't necessarily teach like story structure or things like that, we do teach them to find, tell, and highlight those stories of these moments of meaning, those moments that matter. It's so important for leaders to highlight stories of impact. So either whether they're bringing a customer or patient or somebody to share how, you know, whatever you do impacted them, but also for leaders to share their own stories of impact and say, you know, last week this happened and it was meaningful for me because of that. Because in the sharing of the stories, you are co-creating meaning, and there is no meaning without storytelling, right? Storytelling is a key ingredient of meaning.
So I do a lot of keynotes, and I always start with a story. I just feel like let's just start. And I've got a few different ones, but the one that I sort of anchored on for the first like 5 years of my career doing this stuff was the story, a true story, that it was a beginning of summer, a Friday, end of the day. I'm picking up my office, and my son Nick was 10 years old, and he was finishing his first week of improv classes. He'd never done it before. And the things you need to know about Nick is that, you know, he was chubby. He has weird theater parents, so he's kind of like a weird theater kid. But also he gets bullied at school, you know. So This week, though, was amazing. And we get in the car, and we're leaving Piper's Alley. And he says to me, he goes, Dad, do you know what I love about improv? I go, no, buddy, what do you love about improv? He goes, in improv, if you're nice and funny, you're popular. And this just like, it changed my view of the work I do. And it was like, it was the larger point. Like, I love what there's so many stories when you're in a Second City, obviously, you know, like I started here as a dishwasher in 1988 when Farley was just in the touring company. Mike Myers was on stage. I mean, I have those stories, but this deeper sort of stuff, which ends up being the thing that drove my career for the last 10 years, improv off stage as opposed to improv on stage, is where the good stuff is, the really good stuff, because that's, I mean, if you talk about like Colbert or Tina Fey or Amy Poehler, the improv philosophy drives what they do. They write about it, they talk about it, they embody it as well. And yeah, they're famous comedy stars, but they're just successful people at what they do. And one of the reasons is that they take the philosophy, but they find the ways to actually apply it into the world. And that's kind of what you're getting at. You're trying to make meaning a little bit muscular, a little bit like, you know, it's a big word. Purpose is a big word. Happiness, all this stuff. But what does it mean day to day? And that's something I think you really drive home in the book, is you can do these things with the people around you, and you need to be successful for yourself and for them.
Absolutely. The book is full of these small tools for leaders and for other folks as well that you can apply every day, no matter what job you're in. And we've confirmed that these work across, whether you're a janitor, whether you're an astrophysicist, whatever it is. It is like a muscle. You can practice these things. And one of the things we know from meaning research or the meaning literature also is that reflection, taking a minute to take a step back and to think about what it is that you did, what was meaningful to you throughout the day, to tell that story to another person or just yourself, is a very powerful way to reinforce that meaning. And where leaders come in, like Tamara said, is helping to tell those stories, is helping to create those practices and influencing those things. I think what we didn't get to from the very beginning when you asked about leaders being 50% of meaning in an organization, is that there are all of these practices that leaders can employ to create the environments where meaning thrives, right? And to give people that work for them or with them the tools to do this for themselves and to help them shape that story.
Because if they don't, there's a different narrative that will appear.
Absolutely.
Right.
And that, you know, that could be good, but it's probably not. A couple more stories I want to ask you about, and then I'm going to ask you for your yes and stories.
Awesome.
I love this radiologist study. Can you talk about that one that's in Chapter 8?
Yeah, so it was a study done in University of North Carolina, if I'm remembering correctly.
I think it's an Israeli study, actually.
Oh, it was Israeli, yeah. Okay. But it was where they gave, they had radiologists, you know, look at the scans of the x-rays and give a diagnosis, right? And they wrote out their reports and all of that. And then 3 months later, they gave the same radiologists the same x-rays. They didn't know it was the same. It was like, here's a new batch. This time, though, they included a picture of the patient with the x-ray. And the readings were more thorough, more accurate. And so the idea is that just putting a face to, you know, to the name or to the x-ray, just kind of humanizing that experience a little bit, really increases the amount of effort, the amount of thoughtfulness that we put in, because we care about the impact that we're having when we know who we're impacting.
It's amazing. And anyone who's gone through a healthcare experience, you kind of have to fight to be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunate, but you do. And this is a stunning study because it just shows when you can, your behavior is going to be influenced for the better when you see someone else as human and having a mind. And you know, especially the world we live in right now, where it's so easy to dehumanize when it's easier to go on social media and think that that's an appropriate. The things that people say on social media, if they did that in real life, they'd be appalled. Yeah. It's not real.
Right.
And so I don't know. I mean, it's like, I really wonder sometimes, you know, is this going to naturally change, or is it something that we have to put guardrails in? I suspect it's the latter.
Probably the latter. I think even just this study has huge implications for the way that we work remotely, right? These were radiologists who were not in the same room as their patients, right? And who were reading studies remotely. And in our hybrid environments or when we're working in different places, it's very easy to become transactional with our colleagues, to turn everything that we do into I need you to do this for me and I'll do this for you. And taking the time to create more relational, more authentic interactions with people is so critical to building that community. That, it's something that leaders have to intentionally create the space for.
And it doesn't take long. One of the most powerful question we asked in our quantitative study was, do you know what's happening in your team's life outside of work? Right? Very simple question. And the people who were managed by leaders who did know what was happening felt a much stronger sense of community and belonging and mattering. Like they matter. Somebody cares about me and knows what's going on. And it really doesn't take that long. It doesn't cost anything, you know, to find out, hey, how was your weekend? What did you do? And then to remember that, oh, hey, how was your son's wrestling match? And just, you know, send some article that you saw about wrestling, and those little moments really create a sense of belonging, of being seen, of mattering. And they build a strong foundation. We talked about other people matter, right? Being the foundation. It really creates that strong foundation so we can collaborate well together, trust each other, and, you know, have these meaningful moments.
Tamara's son's wrestling match went really well over the weekend, by the way.
but it has to be designed. It's like it's not just good. Like, you can have your good behavior or your, you know, conscientious behavior, but you have to design this stuff. And we had Horst Schultz on, who is one of the founders of Ritz-Carlton. And I'd love you to talk, because another example of how they've designed that very intentional thing with each of their employees.
Ritz-Carlton has these gold standards that they teach everyone. And if you want to look at an ideal model for how to onboard people and how to talk about values and then give people the space to bring those values to life in an organization, I can't think of any company better than the Ritz. So they have these principles for how they treat guests. They go through a lengthy onboarding process of teaching these principles. They have stories of people living these principles at the Ritz-Carlton. One of them is in our book. It's a story about a lost stuffed animal, giraffe, Joshy, who gets left behind at a Ritz-Carlton in Florida. And they, you know, the father realizes that he's been left behind once they get home and calls and says, you know, tells the son is, you know, just inconsolable, yeah. Right? Because his favorite pet giraffe has been left behind. He tells him, oh, he stayed behind for a couple of extra vacation days at the Ritz and he'll be back soon, right? And in the meantime, is frantically calling the manager at the Ritz saying, can you please send the giraffe back as soon as possible? And I've told my son, you know, he's spending a couple of extra vacation days, but he's freaking out. And the giraffe arrives a couple of days later, but it's not just the giraffe. It's this photo book of the giraffe at the pool, like hanging out in the lounge with other stuffed animal friends, you know, riding around in a golf cart, getting massaged, all of that stuff, which was above and beyond. You know, how are you not just going to fix a problem for someone, but really make them feel like a special member of the community? And in Ritz-Carlton's words, create a Ritz-Carlton guest for life. Right. And so they teach this practice and then they give all of their employees the space to bring it to life. And I think $2,000 per incident that they're allowed to spend, no questions asked, to do whatever they think is best to solve a guest issue or just to do something special for one of the guests when they're in the property.
I just had this. So it was a Marriott. And you talk about them in the book, too. And I got there, and you had to pay for internet, which is a pet peeve of mine. And it's
so annoying. And
so I then get an email from them saying, is everything okay? Like, you've entered. I'm like, no, I shouldn't have to pay for internet. and I did, and I had already put my credit card down because I needed it. And then she's like, oh, you actually don't. If you just sign up for this program, it doesn't cost anything. We're not going to bug you. This is what you do. So I did. And I said, well, I've already paid for it. She goes, no, you haven't. I took it off your bill. Completely, like, I went from annoyed to delighted. Mm-hmm. So, and I think this idea of creating intentional delight inside companies, every company should have a way of doing that. Because it's just, especially with, this is such the best thing when things go wrong. It's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
This is this improv thing of you learn to make mistakes work for you and you see all obstacles as gifts. These are opportunities to change the story in such a better way. And all it takes is a reframe. It's not that much money.
Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, as you were saying this, I think it's yes, creating these moments of delight for customers and having the autonomy, like people at the Ritz Carlton have, in a budget to do what they think is right. But I think a key part of this that is missing from most organizations is creating these moments of delight for their teams and their employees too. It's not just external facing, because the more delighted we are, you know, by these moments at work, the more we bring it out to the customers, right? And so I think customer experience and moments of delight are really important, and so are moments of delight for the employees.
Well, and I found the quote, because you talked to Debbie Marriott Harrison, and she says that the company motto is take care of associates and they will take care of the customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm sure that's what happened in my situation. And I think it's rare, honestly. All right. I'm going to ask each of you for your yes and story. Wes, do you want to go first?
Sure. My yes and story is at the beginning of my career. So I worked for about a year at an insurance company, my first job out of college, and I hated it. I was living in New York and I thought it was so boring. And I had some friends that were opening a nightclub in Miami. And I said, I'm just going to come bartend for you. I'm leaving all of this behind. I'm going to do exactly the opposite. And I'm just going to hang out and figure out what I want to do. And so while I was, before the club opened, while I was, waiting to start bartending there, they let me follow around the woman who was the marketing director of the nightclub, because I was interested in learning a little bit more about how it was promoted, how you get people in and all of that sort of thing. And so that was really interesting to me. And about a month before the nightclub launched, she left because she got an offer to get to open her own club in New York, which ended up being very successful. But all of a sudden there was no marketing director and they were like, do you want to take the job? You know, we've got to get this thing off the ground and you've been following her around. And I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm not qualified for this at all, but sure, I'll do it. I'll take it on. And I was in way over my head and, ended up leading me to a career in hospitality, you know, that I was in for 10 years and ended up being a really great decision. But I was very nervous about saying yes to that.
I love it. You were brave. Tamara, what's your yes and story for us?
You know, my yes and story is actually with Wes. So we met in graduate school the first day and we hit it off and we both came in wanting to learn more about meaningful work. And he really wanted to study leaders and do some kind of qualitative or quantitative study. And I wanted to kind of create more of a theoretical framework and, you know, kind of do a little more desktop research, just read papers and write a book. And from the beginning, he was like, you know, we should really do this together. And I was like, yeah, no. Like, let's just collaborate. And he was like, no, but like, we're kind of doing the same thing. Let's just do it together. And I was like, no. I kind of just want to do my own thing. And he, you know, after a few months of persisting and explaining why it made sense, I was finally like, all right, yes, let's do it together. And it was amazing, right? It was the best decision I ever made. I'm very happy for his persistence. And
I wore her down over many months. Yeah.
Like a business rom-com.
Indeed. I will note, though, that she waited until after I had done all the work of submitting the IRB, you know, to the university to have to do the research study, which was smart, strategic on her part.
I would definitely say so. The book is called Meaningful Work, How to Ignite Passion and Performance in Every Employee. Wes and Tamara, thanks so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming at the top of their lungs.
survive.